Good morning, listeners. Welcome to a brand new episode of The Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute, the Tolkien Professor, and Middle Earth Network Radio. We're here live in the Mythgard Institute's Netmoot interface with a bunch of our awesome listeners to talk about Radagast the Brown today. One of the most interesting topics from the film, since there's seems to be a lot of new material that Peter Jackson and company are adding, and a lot of innovation. And he seems pretty plugged into the parallel White Council necromancer storyline. So we're really excited to talk about it. We're also going to delve into controversy today by talking about the infamous Hobbit app that was released late last week, and the possibility that they're actually changing the ending of the first film. I'm not convinced, but I'll be curious to hear what my cohorts have to say. That's right, I use the word cohorts because I am joined not only by the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, but also by my digest partner, Trish Lambert. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. That's right. So yeah, we do hope to cover the two things today. We wanted to talk about Radagast because it is a very interesting question. Certainly one of the things which has a lot of room for expansion from from the material we get from the books. And obviously there's been a lot of press about this as well since everybody loves Sylvester McCoy, and so there's been a lot of talk about his role, and he was probably, apart from the whole Nazgul thing, which is what we focused on in the reports from CinemaCon, the footage that was shown at CinemaCon. So the idea that like the Nazgul are apparently going to be players in this film in some way was sort of sufficiently shocking to us that that's what we really fixated on at the time. But of course, in many ways, based upon all the reports, the appearance of Radagast in those sections was the real sort of showstopper moment in some ways. That was something that everyone was commenting on. And we didn't even talk about it too much at the time, so we're coming back to Radagast today.
I personally think the showstopper are the giant bunnies.
Well, exactly. I should say Radagast and his associates, perhaps, were the real, whether it be the bunnies. And by the way, do we have evidence? I mean, this is really hard because we're all based on, this is all based on secondhand accounts of that footage, but that they are giant bunnies? I wasn't sure. I knew that he was pulled on a chariot or sled or something, pulled by bunnies. But are they indeed giant bunnies, or just a large number of regular bunnies?
I think they're giant bunnies.
Yeah, giant bunnies. Okay.
Yeah, just for good measure, I'm gonna Google this, but I'm pretty sure there are confirmed sightings
of legitimately giant bunnies.
Yes. Now, I actually saw on somebody's post, I think it was on the One Ring, that somebody said they weren't bunnies, they were hedgehogs. So now we've got that question as well.
Hedgehogs? How could you mistake hedgehogs for bunnies?
For bunnies, I don't know.
I mean, that's very...
Oh, wait, here we go. Quick Beams, One Ring report, I guess, from back in April for the CinemaCon thing. He says... Yeah. The only other shot of Radagast was him flying by in a sled. Radagast has a sled that runs on the forest floor, drawn by larger-than-life but not giant gray jackrabbits.
Okay. Okay. So middle ground, therefore. Larger-than-life but not giant. Okay.
Abnormally large but not freakishly
right.
large.
Rabbits of unusual size, right. Yeah.
Bunnies on steroids, right?
Yeah. Okay. Rabbits of unusual size. Okay. So, well, that's... right. Interesting.
Pete in the Netmoot confirms. He says he heard from Cliff Broadway. Oh, that's Quick Beam, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're not. They're really big, just bigger than normal bunnies, but not like What was that? What was that? The movie with the imaginary giant rabbit friend,
Harvey.
Harvey. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Did you never see that, Corey? Oh, that's a great movie.
No, I missed that one.
Oh, you'd like it.
But, to me, the number one thing that suggests is that we're not being invited to imagine that. Because, I mean, if they were truly giant bunnies, I mean, if these were bunnies the size of ponies or something like that, then one could imagine that, they could be deployed in battle or something, which seems not to be the case. It is still the one Radagast expectation that I am not going to let go of, which is that I fully expect Radagast to show up at the Battle of Dol Guldur like Dr. Doolittle going to war.
With an army of animals.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh man. The attack of Radagast and his animal friends. I cannot wait to see.
Do you think he'll be rallying them with a Theoden like speech?
I'd like to see Radagast addressing the ranks of squirrels and bunnies and hedgehogs and everything and being like death and a little I can see it. I can see it. But no, I mean I feel confident is going to happen. That we're going to have the attack of Radagast and the animals, and it's going to be awesome. So
Daniel does point out that it sounds more like Narnia than Middle Earth if you have that happen.
Well, see, I mean, yeah, I can see that. Now, of course, the main difference is that the animals aren't going to be talking, I assume. Because again, and that would be sort of the point of it would be that to reflect Radagast's greater, relationship with the animals.
Right.
And that I have to imagine that aspect of Radagast's character, one of the few prominent facts that we have about Radagast. In fact, I would put it at number two. The number one fact we have about Radagast is that he wears brown. The number two fact that we have about Radagast is that he's a friend of birds and beasts. And after that, our list of known facts about Radagast is very short. That he dwelt at Ros Gobel, even that one I would call less rock hard because we don't know when. Gandalf speaks of it in the present tense in The Hobbit, and he speaks of it in the past tense in The Fellowship of the Ring.
Right.
That he dwelt at Ros Gobel. So
for all we know, he's an itinerant dude, and he spent the night there once.
Who knows? Who knows? So his association with Ros Gobel is does not even fit into the category of rock solid things that we know about him.
By the way, is that the correct pronunciation, Ros Gobel?
Ros Gobel? Yeah, I would think so.
I always imagined there was some kind of fancy, crazy thing going on with the RH at the beginning.
Well, I don't think it's too crazy, but in fact, it's actually kind of unusual. That spelling is kind of unusual for Tolkien's names. He actually tended to try to avoid especially consonantal combinations, which would really give his readers trouble. I mean, he this is why, for instance, initially he had been thinking of Galadriel's name having the DH consonant in it, that it would not be Galadriel, but Galadriel, like the Galothrim that she's ruling over. But in the end, he rejected that because, he said that he thought the DH looked uncouth to modern English readers, which doubtless it does, because we don't have that combination in modern English. So he tended to not do that kind of thing very much. So the RH at the beginning of a word is kind of a departure from the way that he sort of spells other things. But again, you see him more willing to do it in small things like that. That is, Ros Gobel, if people can't really pronounce that right, whatever. It's no major loss. It's only mentioned once in passing in a speech. It's not, a major character's name. Anyway, so there's not too much that we know about Radagast. And since I'm on the subject, I might as well continue with my list of stuff that we know about Radagast, because you could take everything that Tolkien wrote about Radagast, at least in all of the published materials, and put it on about three pages of text. There just is not all that much. So let me just kind of do a quick review of those things. One, the reference in The Hobbit. The reference in The Hobbit is really short. I'll read you the whole thing. It is when Gandalf is meeting Beorn, and Beorn says that he's never heard of him. And he's never heard of Gandalf. And Gandalf says, "I am a wizard. I have heard of you if you have not heard of me. But perhaps you have heard of my good cousin Radagast, who lives near the southern borders of Mirkwood." Notice lives in the present tense. "Yes, not a bad fellow as wizards go, I believe. I used to see him now and again," said Beorn. And there you go. That's the appearance of Radagast in The Hobbit, as it appears in the published work. Now,
it's easy to see how they can build off of that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's really tantalizing, isn't it? But see, again, this falls squarely into the category of stuff which, once you actually start playing out the story as it is developed later on, Radagast's... Well, basically, you have to make a choice, I think. If Radagast is not involved, if he's not involved with Gandalf and Galadriel and Saruman and Elrond as they're trying to kick the Necromancer out, well, that itself is a big decision. I mean, you've made a big choice about Radagast's character if you make him not involved there. And I'll come back to the direction in which that choice seems to go, you know, that as Tolkien was thinking about it himself later on. But yeah, I mean, it's like he's there. He's right there in the area. He is described as being right there on the edges of Mirkwood, living not too far from the Necromancer himself. Like, if he's not involved, you need an explanation for that. So, I mean, that seems to me a very natural kind of thing. Of course, obviously, the biggest appearance of Radagast that we ever get, in fact, the only time he is ever seen, the only lines of dialogue we ever get from him or anything, is not even directly, it's indirectly in Gandalf's story to the Council of Elrond when he's telling about what happened to him and how he ended up locked up in Orthanc. And that's, of course, when he meets Radagast the Brown near Bree, Radagast coming up the Greenway, having been sent by Saruman with this message, and the things that we know about Radagast from here, I'll sort of read some of the more important moments there. Radagast is, of course, says Gandalf to the council, a worthy wizard, a master of shapes and changes of hue, and he has much lore of herbs and beasts, and birds are especially his friends. That sentence, I think, I'm suspecting that sentence is going to be an enormously important one that will inform how they're thinking about the films. And I say that actually with more confidence than I would have said it 10 years ago, or 12 years ago, or before the first films came out, or even after the films, because basically, I mean, I will say, and I'll come back to this later on when we talk about the Hobbit app, I have been, and I continue to be, impressed at how much the filmmakers do seem to be paying attention to the stuff that we have. Often it's very little. But when we get a passing... there's lots of stuff that's supplemented. You know, there's lots of additional imaginative work that they're putting into things to fill out the story. But I have yet found very few things in any of the stuff that they've released, very few evidences of them actually disregarding or altering a concrete fact that we have, especially like these sort of minor things. I was thinking about this, and I said, we'll come back and talk about this later when we talk about the dwarf descriptions in the app. But I was noticing it then as well. So this kind of a sentence, I actually would, based on what I've seen from them so far, I would expect the filmmakers to take that sentence kind of seriously, and it's interesting. Master of shapes and changes of hue. That does suggest that Radagast is a shapeshifter and can actually change his own form in a quasi-Bjorn-esque way, perhaps, and that he has lore of herbs and beasts, and birds are especially his friends. So he is, you know, we know that Gandalf himself can converse with animals, and so obviously Radagast can as well. And Gandalf, who is described, I mean, you remember the words of Frodo's lament to Gandalf that he writes when they're in Lothlorien, you know, he speaks to bird on bough and beast in glen, in their own secret tongue he spoke, he says, and their own secret tongues he spoke. I mean, Gandalf is famous for being friends with birds and beasts, but by Gandalf's standards, Radagast is a special friend of the birds and beasts. So clearly that he's going to be those two things, his closeness to the animals and his being a master of shapes and changes of hue, those are the two things that I would expect that the filmmakers would kind of take to the bank and work with when developing Radagast's character. The only other things that we know, of course, Radagast never comes up again. Okay, that's not true. There's one very, very small reference. When the scouts are going out from Rivendell before the company leaves in the next chapter, after the Council of Elrond, we're told that Elrond and Elrond here that the scouts stopped by Hrolskobel to see if Radagast was there, and he wasn't. And that's the only thing, the only other thing we ever hear is his absence at that point. Now, the last thing I want to bring up, these are things that that some people may be less familiar with because they're not in The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit himself, but that is the stuff that we learn about Radagast from the essay on the Astari, the essay on the wizards, that Tolkien wrote in Unfinished Tales. And here we have two different facts that we learn about Radagast, and they are, as Christopher Tolkien himself recognizes in his commentary on this section, well, I will say it more, even more strongly than Christopher Tolkien does, I would call them flatly contradictory, basically. I think they show us Tolkien thinking in two very different directions about Radagast. The one, and this is a fairly famous one, which is often quoted about Radagast, is that about how Gandalf, of the five wizards, the two blue wizards who go off into the east, Radagast and Saruman and Gandalf, of the five wizards, only one remained faithful. That's Gandalf. He's the only one who succeeded. The rest of them failed. And he was the last comer. For Radagast, the fourth, became enamored of the many birds and beasts that dwelt in Middle-earth and forsook elves and men and spent his days among the wild creatures. Thus he got his name, which is in the tongue of Numenor of old and signifies, it is said, tender of beasts. So Radagast failed, Tolkien says. He did not remain faithful. His lack of faith is described as essentially his kind of going native with the birds and beasts, that he stopped doing his job, which was to fight against Sauron and to help elves and men, as Gandalf is doing. He ceased to do that because he began to focus too much on the birds and beasts. He spent his days among the wild creatures instead of helping elves and men. Now, the other reference that I was pointing to, which seems potentially, I think quite likely contradictory to that, is in sort of the notes to another narrative which Tolkien had conceived of, which he didn't fully write, but Christopher Tolkien tells us what his notes were. Tolkien was planning basically a council back in Valinor before the Astari came over. So you've got these spirits who are going to become the wizards, and you know, Manwë is basically like, okay, can I get some volunteers? Who's willing to go over to Middle-earth and help folks out? And there are only two of these spirits come forward. One is Kurumo, who is Saruman, and the other is Alatar, who's one of the blue wizards. They're the only two volunteers. And then Manwë is like, hey, where's Aloran? I want Aloran. Basically, Manwë is recruiting Gandalf. And Gandalf goes and, like, Saruman Kurumo, that is kind of bitter about that. When they go, when Kurumo and Alatar, the blue wizard, go, they each take a second with them. Alatar takes his friend, Palando, whom he chooses for friendship, as is told. Kurumo, Saruman, however, gets saddled with Radagast against his will. He has Radagast foisted on him. Radagast's name in Valinor was Iwendil, and Kurumo took Iwendil because Yavanna begged him, we're told. So Iwendil is a spirit who is affiliated with Yavanna, who is the Valar, who is in charge of growing things. She is the one who is the overseer and the caretaker of plants and animals. And so Radagast is her spirit who is foisted on Saruman against his will, who thinks he's an idiot. And this, of course, seems to be picking up on Saruman's words to Gandalf in the Fellowship of the Ring when he shows his contempt for Radagast, you know, calling him Radagast the bird tamer, Radagast the fool. But again, what I think is interesting and at least potentially contradictory here is that he's a spirit of Yavanna. There is no way, like, he can't possibly have too much love for the birds and beasts. That seems really unlikely. To say that his attention to birds and beasts was excessive and constituted failure of his job, that's really hard to imagine how that could be for a spirit of Yavanna. You would think that Yavanna would actually be interested in sending a spirit who's going to be looking out for the birds and beasts. Like, okay, you know, let Aloran take care of the elves and men. He's got that taken care of. I want Radagast to be looking out for the birds and beasts. One could easily see Yavanna thinking something like that.
Well, it could be from the different, you know, from, it depends on the point of view. I mean, from Manway's point of view, he may, you know, Yavanna may have actually taken Radagast aside and said, listen, I know you're supposed to go, you know, do Sauron, but what I really want to make sure you do is protect the birds and bees from Sauron, where Manway may have been like, no, no, you know, all of you are going over to help the elves and men. So it may have just been a point of view thing where Yavanna actually gave Radagast like a secret mission, which he, you know, made his priority.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, and I would say, I mean, to me, one of the biggest differences, or let me say this a different way, one of the things that is pretty clear in that initial essay on the Astari, which includes that reference to Gandalf being the only one who didn't fail, one of the overall sort of functions of that essay, one of the things which Tolkien seems to be really emphasizing, you know, I guess, like, if you'd say, like, what was he trying to get across? One of the things he's trying to get across is basically, like, Gandalf is awesome. You know, how, what Gandalf's success meant, how, I mean, this is really, it's, well, I mean, it sounds, it was really cheapening to call it Gandalf propaganda, but it is clearly a desire, it reflects a desire on Tolkien's part to emphasize to readers, not that this was ever published in his lifetime, but anyway, his desire to explain and emphasize the significance of what Gandalf did. Because, of course, you know, there's, although there are references to it in The Lord of the Rings, that is how big a deal it was that Gandalf accomplished what he accomplished and what that meant. Nevertheless, his glory is shared with Aragorn becoming king and with Frodo and, you know, the shift of the narrative coming back to the hobbits. It sort of seems almost as if Tolkien was like, okay, now, you know, I don't think I made it clear enough exactly how awesome Gandalf was and how stupendous was his success. And so he really expands on that in this essay on the Astari. So it kind of sounds like he's kind of throwing Radagast under the bus a little bit for the sake of really sort of emphasizing, you know, not that he was wicked, not that he fell into evil. He wasn't as bad as Saruman or as bad as he suggested the three wizards, the blue wizards got at that point. You know, he suggests that they, you know, they probably, you know, went off and founded, you know, like magic cults and stuff, you know, became, actually, again, became corrupted and evil out in the East. So he doesn't throw Radagast under the bus as hard as he throws the blue wizards under the bus. But anyway, he, you know, he clearly wants to take this, you know, to shine the spotlight on Gandalf there. Then later on, when he's thinking through the story more, he seems to want to put Radagast in a different place by affiliating him with Yavanna, which seems to give a kind of a retroactive blessing to his attachment to birds and beasts, I would say. Anyway, that's about it. That is about the sum total of what we know about Radagast the Brown, period.
I slightly off-topic question on that essay. So you said that Curano and the other blue wizard, they went over at the same time. So did Olorin come later?
Yeah, and that was something that was, I mean, generally, yes, in most of the versions of this, Gandalf is the one who came later. And because he was like, he wasn't quick to volunteer. And again, the emphasis there is not that he was unwilling, you know, that you know, like Gandalf is out there with a...
resisting.
Yeah. Right. You know, like, you know, hiding, or that he's out there, like, you know, with a beer and saying, don't bother me, you know, but rather that he basically is a sign of his humility, you know, that he didn't want to kind of put himself forward, that he didn't, you know, unlike Kuramo, who was like, well, obviously I am the one for the job, which is kind of a bad sign, right? That Kuramo is the first one to jump forward. And, of course, we see where Saruman's own pride and his opinion of himself leads him in the end. So that is the direction that I see Tolkien taking, that Olorin's reluctance to step forward is the same thing that leads him to remain faithful, you know, to be able to be in the background, to be merely a steward, as he calls himself, in The Return of the King, and not a leader, you know, and not actually a ruler in the way that Saruman wants to set himself up as a ruler.
Did he return back to Valinor after the
Radagast?
Yes.
Yeah, no idea. No idea what happens to Radagast.
I asked that because I'm digging through the TolkienGateway.net article on Radagast. Because one of the listeners in the Netmoot, Daniel Helen, actually wrote it.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Daniel was helping us from the Gateway last time.
Yeah, and he quotes this poem from I guess it's from Unfinished Tales. Wilt thou learn the lore that was long secret of the five that came from a far country? One only returned, others never again. Which seems to suggest that of the five, Gandalf's the only one that ever went back.
Yes. Yeah, that passage is it's a poem in alliterative verse as part of that initial essay. Exactly. And so that is of a piece with that, basically the stuff that says that he failed. So, that he would not have been welcomed back because he failed in his trust. But again, it is not to me obvious that is Tolkien's final answer on the question. I mean, just as, for instance, very briefly, but fairly spectacularly, later in his life, he took back the bad things he said about the Blue Wizards. And this is, I think, sort of an interesting pattern where you see like his wanting to emphasize Gandalf's greatness, and so he does so by diminishing the three other. I mean, Saruman is already taken care of, but the other three get diminished in order to make Gandalf shine brighter in the essay on the Astari. But then later on, he seems to kind of regret that, and especially with the Blue Wizards, far from suggesting that they became, you know, that sort of the founders of these magic cults out in the East, he gives them names. I can never remember these offhand. I'd have to look it up. He gives them names, though it's probably, I will bet you that Daniel and Sean Gunner and everybody else on Tolkien Gateway has it there, if you look up the Blue Wizards on Tolkien Gateway. The names that he gave to the Blue Wizards, he doesn't tell their story, but he gives them names which suggest very strongly that they did not, in fact, fail. And he suggests that, in fact, the Blue Wizards did remain faithful and did succeed, and that the success of the Blue Wizards out in the East is part of the reason why Sauron's armies weren't even bigger when it came to the War of the Ring, because they were out there and kind of helping.
Isn't one of their names like Palando or something?
Yeah. Alatar and Palando are their names from that essay. Those notes I was just reading from. Those are their Valinorian names before they come over. So it's Aloran and Curamo and Iwendil and Alatar and Palando. But then they're given names.
Find their other names.
Yeah, their names.
Tolkien Gateway doesn't have them. Come on, Daniel.
Daniel.
Get on it, guys. Come on now. Let me see here. I think I can probably come up with it. But it means like...
Oh, he tells us... Oh, Robert and Daniel both spoke up at the same time. Morinatar and Romestamo?
Yes.
Romestamo.
There they are. There they are.
They really did say that exactly at the same time. Robert included the accents.
Yes. Yes, bonus points to Robert for getting the accents in place. Yeah, very good. Yeah, I'm...
Morinectar. Okay, thank you, Robert. Daniel's saying he's going to have to rewrite the Blue Wizards article.
Yes. This is, in a brief essay that he wrote. This is on page 384 of The Peoples of Middle-earth. I found it. Since we're on the subject, I wasn't planning to do this, but we might as well do this. Let's see. It mentions there's a penciled note that says, Radagast is a name of Mannish origin. Anduin Vale, notice, is not saying it's Numenorean speech now, but not now clearly interpretable. So he's actually taking back the idea. He's wanting to change the idea that Radagast's name is in the Numenorean speech and has that known meaning. And the other two came much earlier, at the same time probably as Glorfindel. That is when Glorfindel comes back to Middle-earth. Glorfindel was sent to aid Elrond and was preeminent in the War of Eriador, but the other two Astari were sent for a different purpose, Morinatar and Romestamo. And those names translate to Darkness Slayer and East Helper, which by itself, their names suggest that they did not fall into evil. Darkness Slayer and East Helper. they are called. Their task was to circumvent Sauron, to bring help to the few tribes of men that had rebelled from Melkor worship, to stir up rebellion, and after his first fall, to search out, that is at the end of the Second Age, to search out his hiding, in which they failed, because he wasn't there, and to cause possibly dissension and disarray among the Dark East. They must have had very great influence on the history of the Second Age and the Third Age in weakening and disarraying the forces of the East, who would both in the Second Age and Third Age otherwise have outnumbered the West. So that's again, the larger point here, because of course we're not, I there's no evidence so far that the Blue Wizards are going to make the Hobbit films, but the reason that this change to the Blue Wizards, which is, and this is just an outright flat complete contradiction, like complete change in Tolkien's mind. And I do want to make that plain. When I'm talking about contradictions in Tolkien's thinking here, I don't mean he's just being inconsistent with himself or making mistakes. I mean he's changing his mind. You know, that he's that these characters and these stories are really growing and changing in his mind. You can see that a lot of times throughout Tolkien's life in various of his writings and the things he's thinking about. So the evidence with the Blue Wizards shows he definitely was rethinking as he got towards the end of his life. That stuff that I was just reading, those notes about the Blue Wizards, those are very late in his life, only a few years before his death. So so we can see him rethinking this and wanting, you know, he's already now cast, the recast, that is, the Blue Wizards into these heroic roles out in the East, although they're not, you know, their stories are not really told. However, he doesn't do that same thing with Radagast. We're not told explicitly. You know, his Radagast story has not been recast, but it does suggest to me that perhaps those references to his being affiliated with Yavanna and that Yavanna begged Kuramo to bring him over, that so that basically he seems to be on like a mission for Yavanna, essentially, that she wanted him over here, and that she was sending him for her own reasons in part, does seem to me to be at least a first step towards pardoning him for his, and basically recontextualizing his relationship with birds and beasts as, again, a like an unashamed good thing. But anyway, okay, good, yeah, and good. Pete had just put the translations of those also right before I read them too. So anyway, okay, so that's again, that's pretty much what we know about Radagast. There really is not very much more. So.
You mean we don't know that his that Ross Goble was attacked by spiders?
No, no, that is just not in the books.
For the listeners who weren't paying attention, if like 10 days ago, there was this the film production released an official Hobbit trivia game on Facebook, and one of the questions amongst a number of confusing, befuddling, or possibly downright inaccurate questions, amongst those was one where the question was essentially something like, Ross Goble was attacked by, and then they gave you a list of things, you know, four different things that never attacked Ross Goble. So it was like, I don't... This question was like tripped up people. There were all kinds of people where this question was the major barrier to getting 10 out of 10, because it's like... None of these things ever attacked Ross Goble. What's going on?
Yeah, it's an unanswerable question. And what I would say two things about that. One is, remember what I said last time? I think it was, yes, it was last time when we were talking about the descriptions of the goblins that had been officially released and sanctioned mm-hmm. by Warner Brothers. And I was saying, just because the studio puts it out doesn't mean you can rely on its being accurate or trustworthy, because they don't always know what the people who write that stuff don't always know what they're talking about. And here I sort of wonder, it certainly does suggest that Ross Goble is going to be attacked in the movie. They got that idea from somewhere and they didn't get it from the books.
Yes. Well, so, the one alternative is, Tyler Michael Johnson from Middle Earth Network, mm-hmm. told me that, that Ross Goble is attacked by spiders in War in the North.
Wow. That would be a gaffe. I mean, like, you know, nothing against War in the North, but if you're writing if the person who wrote that quiz actually mistook something that happened in the video game for something that happened in the book,
yep.
that's kind of an embarrassing mistake.
But that would be, in some sense, that would probably be, from the studio standpoint, that would probably be more tolerable than leaking a spoiler about the film inadvertently.
Yes, I suppose so. I suppose so.
I don't know. It was fairly. It appeared to be somewhat rushed and a little sloppy, perhaps.
Yeah.
They also had some strange geographical anomalies, like which, you know, like Corey, what would you say? Dale is what direction from?
Oh, yeah, I heard about Mirkwood. This question.
Wasn't that silly?
It is not north of Mirkwood. It just is not north of it. It's northeast. I mean, it's yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's so anyway,
plus Mirkwood. I mean, you could even. I mean, where in Mirkwood?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this is just something that I don't understand. I've never really understood. It sort of seems to me like people who. I don't know. Places like Warner Brothers, like if I could like give some totally unsolicited advice to Warner Brothers here by our broadcast, which they will probably never hear, I would say, why don't you avail yourselves of like the vast resources of Tolkien geekdom out there? I mean, I am not here even, I'm not thinking of myself as, I mean, there are thousands of people out there, of our listeners and
pretty much anybody who's in the net mood right now.
Exactly. I mean, it's like there are so many times I've seen things like this where they seem to just kind of chuck something together. And I guess it's not just a comment on Warner Brothers. You see this with film studios, with publishers, with all over the place. Like they're going to release some kind of like, you know, promotional thing. And it's like, you know, it doesn't take that much to fact check this stuff. There are hundreds and thousands of people who would be extremely willing to help with that.
Right. And it wouldn't be that hard to do to turn it into a promotion where you asked people to submit their favorite questions for a trivia thing.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, think how much goodwill they could raise. That's the part that I don't understand. It's like that this A would not be hard, and B would raise enormous amounts of goodwill. And like it's yeah. You know, people say, like, you know, Ed is making some sardonic comments about Warner Brothers here. And the thing is, I get that. Like, I totally get the fact that they're a corporation which is trying to make money and that they're not real fans and everything else. Like, I totally understand that. But I'm stuck on they're a corporation trying to make money. Like, from a purely business standpoint, this would obviously be a smart thing to do. What the heck is there? What's the problem here? Come on now.
Also, and they're not – and the truth is they're not cynically positioning themselves that way. You know, we were during the War in the North documentary thing, we met a number of high-ranking executives from there, and they were positioning themselves as, we're legitimate Tolkien fans. We celebrated Bilbo's birthday last year with a tea online. We're doing all this stuff. We totally love the lore and all that.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, we're going to hold you to that then.
Right. And
I do have one thought that I just want to insert in here. It does not excuse the lack of fact checking, but it did also occur to me that this question may have arisen because it shows up in the movie, that maybe during the Battle of Five Armies or during the Dol Guldur battle, spiders actually do attack Rosco.
Well, yeah, that is the other alternative, that it's a
still doesn't excuse the lack of That's right. That's what you thought.
It's hard to understand how people are supposed to answer that question if it's in a film
right.
they haven't seen.
Right.
Yet.
Yes. Right. Yes. Right.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it's certainly very logical. I mean, I would entirely applaud a like little Ross Goble action sequence. I mean, that's part of the problem, right? I mean, part of the problem is that Radagast's house is, it's in a neighborhood that's really gone downhill in recent years. I mean, that's basically the problem. You know, doubtless when he settled there, it was a really nice place. You know, southern part of Greenwood the Great. I mean, who wouldn't like to live there? But yeah, then he gets these really undesirable neighbors, and the property values just drop through the floor.
Squirrels go black. Yeah.
And exactly. I mean, you've got everything. The spiders are multiplying, and you've got worse things. Absolutely. Ross Goble is in a bad place, and I can easily you can easily see, like, let's get rid of this, you know, this wizard spy who is, you know, living right here on the on the borders would certainly be a prudent thing for Sauron to do. But obviously doesn't change
now
the fact
you know one thing occurs to me, it's just probably a change of subject here, but We did see the inside of Russ Goebel in one of, I think it was one of the vlogs that Jackson did, which seems to, because we also saw the, of course, inside of Bjorn's lodge as well, but it seems to imply that that was a set, that something's actually going to take place in the movie in Russ Goebel.
Good. Well, I mean, you know, I could totally see Gandalf visiting him there. You know, I would kind of, that I could easily see. And again, it would makes perfect sense. Certainly with, you know, once they get close to Mirkwood and things start to, you know, the focus really begins to be drawn there, you got to think that Gandalf is going to recruit Radagast, I guess. Again, not knowing how they're going to handle him in the film. Now, of course, there are a couple, we should probably move a little bit further towards the depiction of Radagast in the film, because there are a couple sort of big questions. I mean, one of the main things, certainly the sensation that was attached to the Radagast footage that was shown at CinemaCon is the silliness of it. I mean, we've already talked about the rabbit sleigh and and there's that scene that's described of the little birds being under his hat, right? So obviously he's going to be funny. So, I mean, the one question is, like, is he going to be a buffoon? Is he going to be comic relief? Is he going to be, you know, Trish, as you've said, is he going to be the Gimli of the Hobbit movies? And, you know, certainly I can be a little bit more sympathetic to that. I mean, I'd kind of rather have Radagast thrown under the comic relief bus than Gimli, frankly. You know, because I mean, is there anybody out there something emotionally invested in Radagast? I mean, we don't know him, right? So if they're going to introduce a character who is there but totally unknown and completely undefined, they have a blank slate in Radagast. So, yeah, I mean, make him funny, make him a buffoon if you want. That's doable. I'm not sure that they're gonna go all the way to making him a buffoon, to making him like a real laughingstock. But I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not all that invested in him not being a buffoon. I'm kind of okay with it. I just hope it's just not like completely I just don't want any completely ridiculous humor, period. Whether it's Radagast or dwarves or whomever.
Right. Right.
I'm all right with some humor, well, just not like, not, you know, I don't know, Will Ferrell type humor.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think you're right. I think he is going to be the comic relief, even more than Bomber is going to be. I mean, you know, Bomber was really the comic relief in the book, wasn't he? But my thought is then, too, like, for example, in the CinemaCon footage that Quickbean wrote about, I think it sounded to me almost like the first time we see Radagast is when he meets Gandalf near the crypts of the Nazgul. And, you know, that's definitely not a funny scene. So Ed just said that he knew it was going to be silly when they cast Doctor Who, and I had the opposite reaction. Although I didn't see McCoy as Doctor Who, my thinking is somebody who could play Doctor Who would need to be able to do both funny and serious. So.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean that does seem to be. I mean, and to be fair with what they did with Gimli as well, much as I dislike that in some ways, it's not like they utterly I mean, Gimli was not just an idiot in the film. I mean, you know, they did manage to, you know, have moments of real seriousness and pathos with him as well. I mean, they did mingle serious with comical, even with Gimli. So, yeah, one could certainly imagine that, you know, McCoy could handle that.
Yeah. So, you know.
So let's think, besides humor, what other kinds of roles, we haven't gotten too much into what role we expect him to play in the film. And I think that's sort of the most interesting question. I think there's been I can't remember where this quote was from, but somebody said somewhere, oh no, this was one of the digested quote unquote spoilers from Dragon Con that were provided by the OneRing.net, none of which were actually spoilers and all of which were things we already knew and some of which were actually suspect. But one of the things they said there was that we know for a fact that his main purpose in the film storyline is to connect the main storyline to the Necromancer's White Council storyline, which seems perplexing to me since Gandalf is involved in both those storylines. So I don't know why you would need Radagast to connect them, but whatever.
that is a little bit perplexing. So wait, he's connecting Say it again?
The main storyline, the
dwarves, the company, the actual Hobbit storyline to the new Necromancer White Council story.
Okay. Actually, no. The more I think about that, the less sense that makes. What on earth does Radagast have to do with the dwarf storyline?
I don't know.
I don't see. I mean, you're right. Obviously, Gandalf is the one who connects those two things. Primarily, who is quite prominently involved in both of them. I could imagine Radagast getting involved, like them making Radagast involved more in the dwarf, you know, Hobbit thing. You know, when they're in Mirkwood or something, I could imagine a Radagast intervention of some kind. But even that's going to be a tangential connection to them. I mean, I'm having a hard time even parsing that. That's why I misheard it when you said it the first time, because it didn't make any sense.
It was so hard to believe.
Yeah, that's really hard to imagine. It's hard to even envision what they're thinking of there, unless he is going to be... I don't know. I mean, unless he's going to travel with them. I mean, unless we're actually going to see Radagast accompanying the party. But that's hard to imagine.
I don't know what that means. What it could maybe mean is just that he's the one that essentially Gandalf's on screen traveling with the company, and that maybe Radagast the Brown is popping up here or there to just kind of redirect our attention to the other storyline. Like, oh yeah, hey Gandalf, don't forget we got that meeting later with the White Council, type thing.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I agreed with Corey about where the Eagles take the company, is because I was thinking, you know, if Radagast is going to be this character that keeps getting promoted, you know, and we see a lot of him, he's got to play a role somewhere. And so my thought had been that the Eagles would actually take the company to Radagast, or that Radagast was the
one agreed with me.
That was Dave's vote. Yeah, that's Dave's vote.
Oh, it was Dave's vote. Oh, sorry. I agree with Dave. Sorry. Yeah,
because right.
I just thought...
Good choice.
You know, he's got to have some role in there someplace, and I just thought that would make sense because we're near his home and it's the beasts and the eagles and all that stuff, and so that might be another one of those connections that they were making at the OneRing.net, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I could see that happening. I mean, I could definitely see, especially with, you know, coming... Well, you know, pointing ahead to the stuff we're going to talk about later, if they are changing where the first film ends,
right.
And if we were not to get Bjorn in the first film, we're obviously going to get the Eagles in the first film,
right?
And it seems equally obvious that we're going to get Radagast. So that, I think, in my mind, makes it a little more likely that the Eagles could take them to Radagast, because. You know, they're not even going to be...
Bjorn won't even be an issue. Bjorn won't even have come up in the first film. Yeah.
So unless they actually end the first film with, like, the Eagles taking them we know not whither...
right. Actually, I could see...
Beyond
I could
the
see
circles
the end of
the
first
world?
Film.
Yes.
I could actually see the end of the first film, and this would be so tacky, but the end of the first film being the Eagles take them away, let them down, and the very last thing we see is this huge bear roaring at them, and that's the end of the first film.
I could see it. I could see it. Or even just like, you know, like with the Eagles flying, you know, and not landing yet, you know, and have second film open with them landing on the Carrick and going to Bjorn's house. But anyway, no, I could imagine that. But let's actually talk about the actual prediction question and the options that we have there to kind of
Because I think I would like to talk a little more about his role on the White Council storyline.
Yes.
And his interactions with the other characters. So but before we launch into the prediction question, the one thing I want to recall is we have seen scenes of him interacting with Gandalf in some kind of catacomb setting.
Yes.
I still like. I'm having trouble keeping straight the Tomb of the Nazgul, Dol Guldur. The same place? Are they different? I'm not sure. But so we don't know exactly where they were interacting. Well, presumably it was the Tomb of the Nazgul, but that might actually be in Dol Guldur. Who knows? But we have seen him interacting with Gandalf there. He was, I don't know if he discovered it first and then Gandalf, and then summons Gandalf, or Gandalf seems surprised to see him, but then Gandalf kind of tries, if I recall, Gandalf like sends him away.
Yeah, that's in the account from the CinemaCon stuff, I think.
Yeah.
Right. Let me read the little passage here. It says, in the scene where Gandalf is walking warily around ruins of some kind, he whips around to see who is sneaking up on him and exhales rather irritated, "Oh, it's you," followed by Radagast's frightened admission that the crypt they're standing in is not a nice place to meet. He also has a glowing crystal piece and a staff, and leaning over the vertical shaft, they both look down over the edge. They count 9 tombs, all with their spells broken and bars ripped. To me, him meeting Radagast like that, given how close Radagast lives to Dol Guldur, does kind of support the idea that these crypts are there, and that's where Gandalf goes.
And we know Radagast is not a traveler.
Right. Yes, good. Yes, I left that out. That is one of the other facts. Gandalf says that to him. You were never a traveler. Unlike Gandalf, you know, who is the great pilgrim. He's the wanderer who has no home and no place that he stays and is continually moving around. Okay, all right. Well, let's go through the options here, and then we can continue discussing this. Okay, so the question is just basically, what function will Radagast serve on the White Council in the Hobbit trilogy? And so here are the options, and actually, Trish, you just added one, which I like better. I'm going to make that's your option is the new D. So here we're going to say option A is really actually this was one that was very challenging to come up with a book answer because there's almost no answer to this question. But option A is that he's honest, that he's a good guy, but he has a minor role, that he's not a major player in the White Council. So he's present, he's helping, but he's a very minor role as far as the White Council.
That is a good D answer. Sorry.
Huh? Yeah, isn't it?
I was just saying.
Yeah. Option
good job,
B.
Chris.
She's brilliant.
Yeah. Option A. So that's option A. He's honest. He's a good guy, but he's got a really minor role. Option B. He's one of the inner circle. He's operating on a par with Gandalf and Elrond and Galadriel. So we see him. You know, he's just one of the major players in the White Council. Option C is that he's Saruman's patsy. That basically he is working for Saruman. Now, I would clarify, this does not mean that he has to be evil. I think right. that he could be entirely well-intentioned, but he's basically subordinate to Saruman.
And trust Saruman and think Saruman
yes.
is
exactly.
Which is old. Which, yeah. Which, in fairness, it's not a knock against his character because at this point everybody trusts Saruman.
Right.
Maybe some people a little less so than others, but their suspicion they don't have suspicions. They just have sort of they had a preference for Gandalf as being the head of the council. But nobody distrusts him at this point. So it doesn't make Radagast a doofus.
No, not at all.
But I think it would have more to do with how they portrayed on screen that there would clearly be the case that Radagast is taking his cues from Saruman. You know that they like in the Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
That he explicitly says, hey, what are you doing here at the Tomb of the Nazgul? Well, Saruman sent me, and
right.
And in the council scenes, he votes the way Saruman votes and stuff.
And he, and he may also well do, carry tales back to Saruman. We could see him telling Saruman about meeting Gandalf and what Gandalf was doing and, mm-hmm. Saruman being very interested in this. And Radagast not really having any idea that he's, betraying Gandalf or anything, but yeah, that he is basically, totally subordinate to Saruman and manipulated actively by Saruman, I would sort of add as sort of a piece of that. And then option D is that he's not a part of the White Council at all. That he's sort of off on his own, and he's not really part of the group decisions when the White Council actually meets and acts.
That's is not implausible, because in the few glimpses of the White Council assembled that we've seen, I don't think we've seen Radagast the Brown there yet.
Yeah. Yep.
And he doesn't really come up. He doesn't really come up in Tolkien's writings, like the appendices talking about the White Council.
The references to the references to the membership of the council is not clear at any point, really, in Tolkien's writings. I mean, in fact, in the first reference to it, in The Hobbit, it's very unclear. This is when it's in the final chapter when he sort of overhears Gandalf telling Elrond about it. It was in this way that he learned where Gandalf had been to, for he overheard the words of the wizard to Elrond. It appeared that Gandalf had been to a great council of the white wizards, masters of lore and good magic, and that they had at last driven the necromancer from his dark hold in the south of Mirkwood. So we have this vague and uncertain size of collection of plural wizards. And then it seems later on that clearly Galadriel is part of it, so that the White Council is not just wizards, that it is also the great elf lords and everything too. So, Elrond and Galadriel are clearly a part of it.
And Círdan. Wasn't Círdan also?
Yeah, presumably, yeah. I mean, it's that, that he's certainly one of the wise. But I mean, certainly, given the Hobbit description there, that is of the wizards plural, it would be hard not to include Radagast there. Especially since, of course, conspicuously, not Saruman, but Radagast is the only other wizard mentioned by Gandalf in the Hobbit. So the only thing that the reader of the Hobbit has to go on when Gandalf says, "Oh, it was a meeting of the White Wizards," is like, "Oh, well, it must be his cousin Radagast and others." And a cousin, of course, I don't take to be, even in The Hobbit, I don't take that to be any kind of a literal familial thing, but like part of his order, as Gandalf says in The Fellowship of the Ring. But anyway.
It's funny, by the time I got to that part of the book, and every time I've read it, I mean, you bringing it up just now actually is the first time I've thought about it, but every time I've read the book, when it gets to that part about the White Wizards, I don't even remember Radagast.
Right.
Because it's so, reference to him is so sparse in The Hobbit, so I didn't even remember him. I was just thinking, oh, well, there's other wizards, obviously. And
I remember you, Radagast.
Radagast gets so little press.
Ed wants to know if Trish's boyfriend is on the council.
Yeah, Glorfindel. Is he on the council? I don't think he is. Is he?
I don't know. We're not given like the we don't see like the minutes of the White Council. Actually, that would be a really funny piece actually to write, like minutes of a White Council meeting. That would be really funny actually. But anyway,
who would be the secretary?
I would actually be tempted to make it Radagast, actually, but...
That's true.
Radagast or one of the elves, Galdor.
Yeah, or maybe Celeborn, like, might as well do something useful, so I volunteer.
Yeah, right, secretary. He comes along with Galadriel, yeah.
Right. Rather than sitting around holding my wife's clipboard, I decided to volunteer to keep the minutes.
Curious to know what are the perennial topics that always come up, that they don't agree on and that they all like nobody agrees on, and they keep bringing it up and hashing it out over and over again.
That's right. That issue that they decide to table for next meeting yet again. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't really know. I mean, I would actually guess. I would guess yes on Glorfindel. But it's really just a guess. I mean, that's based only on the fact that he is clearly a really important figure.
I mean, he's a born again elf, right? I mean,
geez. Exactly. And a returned to Middle Earth elf. That puts him in, I was going to say in really elite company, but that's really elite company all by himself, actually. which I suppose is about as elite as you get.
Yeah. Elite company.
Yeah.
Pretty elite exactly. Company. Yeah.
So what do we think about Radagast's involvement? My suspicion, I think he is going to be on the White Council. And the reason I think he's going to be on the White Council is because I don't think that they're going to want to lose the opportunity. They have some real chances to create some really interesting kind of like political and psychological stuff. And we've talked about this, Dave, a long time ago, a little bit, when we were talking about Saruman and and how they're going to handle the Saruman situation, you know, the ways that they, the opportunities that they're going to have to sort of show the first moves of what is eventually going to be Saruman's game without Gandalf and Galadriel picking up on it, and the dynamics of, like, the two of them, Galadriel and Gandalf, are sort of, you know, in cahoots together, and Saruman feels excluded, and to begin to see the sort of seeds of frustration and anger and pride growing in him. To add Radagast to the mix, you know, somebody who is perhaps wise, but also, you know, in a sort of a more junior position, who is funny, but who, you know, is probably, I assume, based on the pictures they've released, that he's going to be kind of endearing. You know, I think he's going to, he looks kind of lovable, doesn't he? So, I mean, I think that seems to be how they're going to play him. But again, the single biggest thing we have from Radagast in the books, the single biggest point that they have to start with is the way that Saruman plays him in the Fellowship of the Ring. And so I could easily imagine that being, you know, them really wanting to play that up. It is one of the things, it is definitely on my short list. It is on my, like, top five list of things I am most interested to see is going to happen in the films, is how they're going to do these dynamics among Saruman and Galadriel and Gandalf and Elrond in the film. Because I think that there is so much potential for that to be handled really interestingly, and I will be very—I'm very keen to see how they actually do it. And I think that Radagast could play a really interesting role there. For that reason, I think he's going to be there. So I'm definitely not going D, because I think that he's going to be a part of it.
You've eliminated one option. Progress.
Yeah. I've eliminated one option for me.
All right. So
I'm gonna go against,
answer.
I'm gonna go against A too, because I think they're going to make him more than just a very minor role. So I don't think he's just gonna be totally on the outskirts. Which leaves me with B or C, and I'm gonna go with C. Radagast is going to be Saruman's patsy. That's what I'm going with.
Interesting. What's your reasoning for that?
Well,
and how do you think that'll look?
How do I think that'll look? Well, kind of like the way I was describing it earlier, and the things that Dave was saying. That is, I don't think it's going to make him look bad. I think that there's going to be. I think that there's going to be a kind of sort of tragic irony there, you know, that he trusts Saruman and he respects Saruman, and that Saruman is going to be manipulating him. I could actually see Radagast being used by the filmmakers as a tool to give us, the film viewers, our first indications of Saruman's character, that is, of his true character, without revealing it to Gandalf. Like, obviously, he's not going to be, like, cleverly hiding, you know, armies of orcs in his closet. You know, he's not going to be acting evil in those kinds of overt ways, even, I think, in secret. I don't think he's going to do that. You know, have his, like, still top super secret orc R&D department in the basement of Orthanc. Like, I don't think that's going to be happening. But I think that I think that Radagast could be used very interestingly as a kind of go-between between Gandalf and Saruman. If Saruman were too overtly suspicious of Gandalf and Galadriel in person, then the film would have to expect us to see them, that is Gandalf and Galadriel, as obtuse if they didn't pick up on it. But if Radagast is kind of a middleman among Saruman and Gandalf and Galadriel, then basically Radagast could be the only one who has the opportunity to see that he is increasingly distrustful, and he could be sympathetic to Saruman. Again, without being himself corrupt, he could be sympathetic to Saruman's position. And, you know, I think... this is, you know, Trish, why don't you go ahead and pose the other question that you had posed, because to me it bears on this.
Yeah. I was going to bring that up when I answered. I don't think Radagast is going to make it past this trilogy. I think he's going to end up getting killed at some point, possibly in the Battle of Dol Guldur. Two reasons I say that is, one, this is like such a super sympathetic character. I mean, this is such move. It's almost like a trope in the filmmaking industry where you know, the heartstring pull, you know, where you become so enamored of a character like this and then he dies. But probably the even overarching reason is there is literally no mention of Radagast made in the Lord of the Rings films. And if he's going to have such a role in this trilogy, you know, how else are they going to explain not having him show up at all in Lord of the Rings, except that he bought the farm?
Yeah, I actually find that argument fairly persuasive. That's because that's right. If he's going to be a big player here, there almost demands an explanation of why he wasn't in the movies. Like, why is he not a player in The Lord of the Rings if he's such a big player in The Hobbit, at least even if he's any kind of a size player in The Hobbit? And so one obvious explanation of that is that he dies. And this I actually find a very attractive idea, and it's one of the things, thinking about that, is one of the things also that leads me to the Saruman's Patsy vote, because we could actually have a betrayal.
Right.
Not witnessed by Gandalf or Galadriel, nobody else knows about it, but Radagast could actually be one who, by the ends of the films, sees or begins to suspect that Saruman is turning to evil, and Saruman could off him.
Saruman, that's right.
Bumps him off.
Yeah.
You guys are upsetting Yana.
I know. I was just going to apologize to Yana. I've burst his moth bubble.
Yeah. Well, but see, but that's the thing, Yana, that's exactly it. In the Lord of the Rings films, Radagast is no part of that. The moth and the eagle are all Gandalf. So, you know, this is just like the moth is simply obviously a random moth flying by whom Gandalf befriends, right? You know, Gandalf speaks to him, and the moth somehow, I always find a little bit of suspension of disbelief quite necessary in this. The moth finds the eagle, like, what does this moth fly hundreds of miles? Seriously?
But at speed of light.
it's got a jetpack or something. But anyway, but that's exactly it. Radagast is no part of Gandalf coming to Orthanc in the first place, and he is no part of his escape. I think I could really see a moving betrayal of Radagast. You know, if he had trusted Saruman but then because of his trust with Saruman, he trusts Saruman, and so he keeps going to Saruman, and he's the one who is really kind of the liaison with Saruman outside of the formal council meetings, which I assume there will be formal council meetings. He's the one who gets suspicious, because you can't have Gandalf suspicious. It's a huge continuity error for Gandalf to have any suspicion of Saruman, because Gandalf is just touchingly, completely trusting of Saruman at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring film. I mean, I find it really cute, that scene when he's talking to Frodo in Bag End, and he's like, "I will go to Saruman. He will know it. Trust me, Frodo, he will know what to do." It's so adorable.
Right. I can't do anything to violate that.
No. It's clearly but again, you're going to be losing an opportunity if you don't have any – if nobody has any suspicion, right? I mean, if the entire Hobbit trilogy goes by and Saruman is like still being a good boy and there's no problem there, I mean, that couldn't work.
Right.
That couldn't work.
Plus, this is a neat way for us to both – right. It's a neat way for both Radagast to no longer be part of the story and for the audience to know, even though nobody else does now, that Saruman's a bad egg.
Right.
So the main objection to this, in my opinion, which has nothing to do with the story, but more to do with audience reaction, is this the kind of thing that could just really send some Tolkien fans off the deep end?
What, the death of Radagast?
Yeah, killing off a character who did not die.
Well, did he? We don't know. Who knows what happened?
Not
to
it, but he wasn't dead at the time. Killing him off in such a way as to have him be dead in the chronology of the films
right.
at a time when he was not dead.
For
all the good he did.
No, I mean, in the Lord of the Rings films, he might as well be dead.
Right.
But, no, I mean, I see that. But again, I do also, I mean, I would say, I mean, like, seriously, if you're going to, like, fight for Radagast, like, what are you willing to let go? I mean, we get nothing from Radagast. Yes, it would be a violation. Yes, it would be a violation. But here, I feel like, as Trish said, like, you know, there's no point closing the barn door now. I mean, like, he was already omitted from the Lord of the Rings.
Yes. But the possibility you're ignoring is the George Lucas option. So you go back and you refilm scenes from Lord of the Rings. Instead of having Gandalf just say, you know, I'll go to Saruman, he'll know what to do, you have a knock on the door and it's, hey, it's Sylvester McCoy as Radagast Frey. I'm like, hey, we should go see Saruman.
Maybe. Yeah.
Corey, you're so nice. You're not completely.
That strikes me as unlikely, Dave. But I think, No, it's. I am. I mean, I will say that the premises I'm operating under is that Peter Jackson is not going to go George Lucas in general.
He's not going to reshoot and re-release his original Lord of the Rings films.
Oh well, I'm not saying he won't re-release them, or like that the studios won't want to re-release them. But yeah, it's a little hard for me to imagine that.
James says new theory, Radagast turns into a moth at the end of the movie.
That's awesome.
And then what they'll do is they'll actually go into the Lord of the Rings and they'll edit out the moth and it'll be Radagast the Brown flying there.
A little bitty Radagast the Brown.
It all depends on how Peter Jackson's subsequent filmmaking career goes. If he can can manage to make a hit that isn't a Tolkien film, then maybe. But if he has trouble, then maybe he'll start to think, oh, maybe I'll go back and tool around with Lord of the Rings.
Well, let's hope for better things than that. But
so are we just doing an intellectual exercise here, or is this going to be an official question?
It should be a conundrum, but we can't do it until Dave 2
yeah, we have to save it.
Digest. Yeah, we just save
Good
it
point.
For another movie.
Because we don't point out. No one thinks he'll be dead by the end of this film, right?
No. Way. You have to have at least. I mean, maybe by the end of the second film, he could buy it. I mean, they have Boromir, of course, dying at the end of the first film, so it's not like it's impossible to build a relationship with a character and then have him die in a very moving way at the end of film one. But no, I can't with all of the indications of where they're not going to get with the Dol Guldur plot in film one, I can't imagine it.
Besides, I want to see Radagast with his bunny army before he gets
absolutely
toffed.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so Trish and I need to make our predictions. Trish, what's your
prediction?
Corey, you're going to Patsy, right?
Patsy. Yep. C is my choice.
All right.
Corey, you are so you should be a salesperson.
See, this is the problem. Like, you totally shouldn't let me vote first, because then I'll to talk everybody into like my own cockamamie idea, which usually within a week turns out to be incorrect. So
incorrect. Well, I had originally thought of one of the reasons why I thought of the idea of him not being part of the White Council at all was actually that's the direction I was kind of going. But then I would be negating my own thing, which is we need to have him showing up. You know, there needs to be some role for him through the movie rather than just, you know, little bitty pieces here and there. So I did talk myself out of him not being on the White Council. Then it came to ANC. Now, I absolutely can get Corey's thing. You know, I think the idea of him being, especially with regard to what we just talked about in terms of a betrayal. But I think to be controversial, I'll stay with A.
Okay.
Let's do that.
So basically, he's like an
outsider. Just to spread it. Yeah, just to spread. I mean, he'll be there. He may be the secretary. You know what I mean? He'll be there. He'll participate, but not a decision maker or not a major player on the council.
Right.
And I'm doing that so we can spread the wrongness across more than one answer.
That's very generous of you. I, however, am going with Patsy.
Okay.
Are you? Okay, good.
Yes. Okay. And I'm adding the disclaimer that I liked that answer before Corey gave his very convincing spiel.
Well, I was suspecting that, Dave, because you renamed that one, so I could tell I was suspecting you were already
had
thinking
a special affinity for it.
Yeah, I was suspecting that.
Okay. Now, do we want to hear from our group here? Do we want people to?
Yeah. Let's see. You guys should vote.
Oh, Ed, you're no fun. None of the above.
Oh, Ed, who?
Father Roderick who are, answer.
I was gonna say. Who do you think you are, Father Roderick? Here, come on.
Pete's with Corey and Dave. Okay. Oh, Daniel, you're thinking B, huh?
All right.
I mean, thinks okay. He's going to be a player.
Owen's with Patsy. Yeah. So right now it looks like C's kind of the dominant response. And by the way, you guys, don't forget that when this comes up on Riddles in the Dark Predictions page on Facebook, go actually officially log your answers.
That's right.
It's Yana.
Oh, yeah. Yana. Okay, which a quick review again. A is basically like the book. He's a good guy, but he's a minor character, so he's going to be on the fringe of the White Council. B is that he's one of the inner circle of the White Council. He's going to be a major player. He's going to be a good guy, but a major player. C is that he's Saruman's patsy. He's subordinate to Saruman and probably duped by Saruman. And so he's going to be like Saruman's tool and his dupe. And D is that he's not part of the White Council at all, that he doesn't even convene with them. He's just like a maverick on his own in Mirkwood. Okay.
We have some announcements, don't we, to do?
Yeah, and we do have some announcements. And we should move along if we're going to say anything about the – do you want to save the other stuff, Dave? Do we have time?
No, Dave's schedule's opened up.
I have a little extra time. We have time to do it.
Okay,
and it's important. I wanna put our plant our flag on the ground in terms of where we think the film's gonna end. And...
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, then announcements, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Two announcements. Announcement number one is prepare for Hobbit Day on Saturday, September 22nd. And we're doing this on Saturday because it's a Saturday and everybody won't be working. on Saturday, September 22nd, we are going to be celebrating the 75th anniversary of The Hobbit. This is something that the guys from the Middle-earth Network and I are doing. We are planning a day-long event. So we're going to be posting schedule and stuff. We're going to have a whole bunch of things going on. We're going to have readings from lots of people, including scholars and celebrities. We're going to have a release party for my book and some other things. We're going to have check-ins from Hobbit parties that are going on around the country and around the world. We're going to see if we can have a guest appearance by a wonderful panel of Tolkien scholars as it happens on that day. Most of the great Tolkien scholars in the world, I couldn't be there because I had to be over here, but most of the great Tolkien scholars in the world are in Dublin for a major Tolkien conference. So Tom Shippey and Roland Flieger and Michael Drout and Tom Honegger and Dimitri Fimi are all going to be over there in Dublin, and we're trying to see if we can actually pipe them in during the day to do some discussion of The Hobbit on its 75th anniversary. We're going to be doing some – just. A whole bunch of stuff is going to be going on. So, and it's going to be basically an all-day broadcast. It's going to be both video and audio broadcast on that day for the entire day. We're going to be doing we're going to be doing some special Riddles in the Dark stuff. We're trying to get together a live audio panel with as many of our analysts as we can, so we can have some sort of group discussion with all of them live. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, and if there are things, we're still sort of finalizing things. So if there are some ideas that that you guys have, you can feel free to offer up further ideas of things you might like to see. So that's one thing. Just basically circle September 22nd on your calendar. We're going to be broadcasting all day that day. And also the stuff, one question that I've been asked, people have been asking is this stuff going to be recorded? Will it be available? Yes, it will. So you won't miss
it. No, you better be there.
Yeah, we would like you to participate live because there will be a bunch of opportunities for you to participate. So anyway, that is the announcement number one, September 22nd. Keep that in mind. Announcement number two, we have a Mythgard Institute has a special offer for Riddles in the Dark fans. For those of you faithfully listening to Riddles in the Dark, we have a gift for you to thank you for your participation and support of the Riddles in the Dark series. And that is we would like to offer you a discount on any of the course packs that Mythgard has available. So we have recordings of the courses that we have previously offered. You can find recordings of the Lewis and Tolkien class that I taught, the Modern Fantasy class I taught over the summer, Verlin Flieger's Arthurian Literature class, Amy Sturgis's Harry Potter class, the first of our introductory Latin courses, if you've ever wanted to learn Latin. Anyway, all of those things are currently available, and you will get a 25% discount if, when you check out one of our course packs, you add the code, I was going to say top secret, it's not exactly very secret, but the exclusive Riddles in the Dark code, RITD25. That's Riddles in the Dark 25, a 25% discount for all Riddles in the Dark listeners. So just enter RITD25 as your discount code when you check out any of our course packs, and you will get 25% off. So that is a special offer from the Mythgard Institute for Riddles in the Dark fans.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. We're not announcing it anyplace else, but on, of course, this broadcast and the podcast.
That's right. So just for our listeners there. So, okay, those are our two announcements. Now let us move on to controversy.
Yes, I believe Dave is gone away for just a second, and I will be going away for just a second in a little while. But let's get started on this app. Have you had a chance, Corey, to look at the app?
I have, yes. I was looking at it the first night it was released when I should have been doing other things, and it was very interesting. I mean, sort of as apps are, I mean, I don't know. I've never really done movie apps and stuff like that because it's like there's so much. It's so limited. I found it really useful to have the production videos gathered into one place. That's quite convenient. So I can watch those on my iPad. That's nice. Other than that, there certainly was not much in the way of information. The thing I was kind of tweeting about it as I was looking at it on that first night, and the thing that I was emphasizing, what I really liked most were the individual descriptions of the dwarves. I was very interested by their characterization of the dwarves, and this is where, you know, the stuff that I mentioned before that I have been impressed by, I really have been, is that they really do seem to be taking seriously what information we have. It is not, how can I say this delicately? It was not my impression in watching the Lord of the Rings films that they had, I did not watch those and say, wow, these people have really read carefully. Like, they really caught every detail. I was fine with some of the changes that they were making. Like, I totally get that this is an adaptation and not just a translation of the story onto film, everything else. But anyway, there were just a bunch of things that didn't make much sense to me. And they seemed to be missing stuff. But you take the dwarves. Most of them we know almost nothing about. I mean, most of the dwarves that are on the quest remain almost complete ciphers. But there are there's a very short list of sort of facts that we have about these different characters. And each one of those facts that I could think of, they have actively incorporated. They've built on it a lot. Of course, they're clearly trying to develop all of these dwarves into recognizable and individual characters. But you take, for instance, the fact that Dory is the strongest of the dwarves. Well, that's included. That is in fact referred to in the story, that Dory is the strongest one of them. And so that's one thing that they get right. One example that I thought was to me most interesting from this kind of an interpretive standpoint was Ori. Here's the description of Ori that they give in the app. Younger brother to Nori and Dori, Ori is a talented artist and can often be found drawing and writing in his journal. It is Ori who chronicles much of the journey through the wild to the shores of the Long Lake and the slopes of the Lonely Mountain. polite and well-bred. He is used to being bossed around by his older brother, Dory, and is usually biddable, although occasionally he can surprise his fellow companions with his courage and determination. Now, one might be tempted to look at that and be like, they're just utterly making this up. I mean, they've got nothing to go on there. They don't quite have nothing to go on there. What they're going on is the one piece of information we ever learn about Dory, which is that he was the one who wrote, who had right. the really attractive handwriting in the Book of Mazarbul.
In the log in find. The chamber of the of Mazarbul.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Sorry, exactly. I had to jump in and interrupt.
Yeah. Right. Right. He's the one. He's the one who had what Gandalf describes as a fair hand. He has really nice handwriting and could write well and speedily. Says Gimli, and often used the dwarf letters. So based on that one time. Tiny little fact that we get about him, that he had very attractive and fluent handwriting, and was one of the ones who was clearly one of the scribes for Balin's folk who tried to resettle Moria. They took that one tiny tidbit of thing and made it into, oh, so he's a journalist and an artist, so that, you know, he's keeping a chronicle and is, you know, like, you know, whatever. Like, some of the things that they're describing about the dwarf seemed a little bit campy, but the fact is, like, I was kind of impressed
about
the fact
that... That one's not
insane. No, it's not insane. They actually, yeah. like, it's... It has a seed in the only thing that we know about Ori. So yeah. that was something that I found pretty consistent.
I would like to say I'm particularly proud of the fact, and you can take credit for this. This is the influence you're having on me. So Father Roderick and I did like a 3-part Secrets of the Hobbit like episode marathon one weekend. It was like 4 hours of podcasting where we went through these things in detail. And I caught this on the Ori thing. I was like, Wait a minute. I think I know this. I was pretty excited. And I had much the same sort of spiel that you just gave, which is this is actually this is an example of them sort of, I think, doing something extremely reasonable and probably sort of maybe similar. You know, it's the kind of thing that if Tolkien were to go back and revise, he might do. And it opens up the interesting possibility. Maybe Bilbo gets the idea for his red book from the diary and log that Ori is keeping as they travel.
Right.
So, yeah, it's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. It is, and then you've got some like where they're completely, you know, where they have absolutely nothing to work with, like Bofur, for instance. Other than Bofur's relationship with Bomber and Bifur, which changes around, by the way, in the drafts of The Hobbit. But anyway, where it's settled to in the published text is that Bofur is Bomber's brother and Bifur is Bofur's cousin. So Bomber and Bofur are brothers, and their cousin is Bifur. That's literally all we know about Bofur. I mean, we get nothing else about Bofur. And so they've, you know, made up this whole character and backstory of Bofur that he's, he has a love of music and a fine singing voice, and is unfailingly optimistic. This is all, you know, he joined the quest for the Lonely Mountain partly to seek his fortune and partly because he was told the beer was free. Okay, so we have, you know, so we have, like, the fun-loving guy. You know, there's also... Who is the guy who's, like, the rogue? The one who is... always doing, like, illegal things. Which one was that?
Yeah, crap. Who was that?
Is it Bifur? No, Bifur's the one with the orc axe in his forehead, which I love.
Yeah.
Which has rendered him inarticulate and occasionally feisty.
I dig up the notes for that. Dang it.
Is it Nori?
Here they are. I found him. Maybe.
No, it's not.
Let's
Nori.
Let's see.
It is. Yes. Nobody ever quite knows what the quick-witted and wily Nori is up to, except that it's guaranteed to be dodgy and probably illegal.
Probably illegal.
Yeah. But he's immensely...
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah. Me neither. But, I mean, there are a lot of these characters. I mean, it's a real challenge if you're going to do what it's been obvious from the beginning that Peter Jackson was going to do, which is not make these dwarves a faceless crowd, but actually give each one of them a recognizable personality and distinguish them both visually and character-wise so that the audience of the films actually differentiates them and can, you know, develop a kind of relationship with them, with each of them. I mean, you've got your work cut out for you when you've got 13 of these people, plus Bill,
yes,
plus
Gandalf. Yeah, and for the record, it would not be a good and effective film if they didn't go out of their way to differentiate these guys, yeah, and make them individual characters and stuff. So,
yeah, no, I mean, I could, you know, as we've been talking about that for a while, that that's just one of the fundamental way, you know, when you know, people sometimes generalize about like, well, you just can't, you know, you can't do storytelling the same way in a book as in a film. To me, this is one of the clearest examples. You can have faceless characters in a book because if they don't come in, you can just say like, them and the other 13 of them ran down the, but you're not actually seeing the other 13 of them. You can draw the reader's attention to one or two and have that, mm-hmm, be satisfying. Have one of them, yep, speak for all of them in essence. But you can't do that on screen when you're actually looking at 13 people standing around not talking and not doing anything.
Yep.
That's just not an option. So yeah.
So
I can suck up to Corey and say that I've been doing my homework for the current Secrets of the Hobbit, the Hobbit story, and reading the Priftan fragment, which is the early, like the first few pages, a few pages from the first chapter. He actually had more dwarves speaking in that first chapter than he ended up having, I noticed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he had like four or five different dwarves interacting in the conversation, and then now there's not. I mean, in the published chapters, like maybe one other dwarf besides Thorin, right, that talks?
Yeah, Glóin, basically, who,
yeah,
does his,
right,
you know, more like a grocer than a burglar.
Right, right.
But yeah, absolutely. No, that's a very noticeable trend, is that as Tolkien revised the book moving towards publication, he streamlined it that way. You know, I mean, he deliberately diminished the speaking roles of the other dwarves and consolidated them so that there were one or two that we would attach to and that we would attach something to. Dori, Glóin, Balin especially.
Mm-hmm. Ratliff makes the point of saying that he thought that Tolkien was making the revision to make it easier for the story to be read aloud and for the audience to be able to keep track of the characters more easily.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, exactly. Like fewer characters talking kind of thing. But you're, yep, right, for a movie that doesn't work. For a movie, you got to have all of them.
Yeah, but again, almost every character, almost every aspect of, like, of, you know, almost anything that gets a positive mention, anything that's actually present in the text, they have actually incorporated. You know, they made up a whole bunch of other stuff around the sides of it. But, you know, I think of, you know, here's Glowin's description. Of all the members of the company of dwarves who set out on the quest of the Lonely Mountain, Glóin is the most outspoken and opinionated and is not afraid to challenge authority. Well, outspoken and opinionated, of course. What Glóin is most famous for is that comment he makes in Chapter 1 about thinking that Bilbo looked more like a grocer than a burglar. There's almost no other role that Glóin has in the entire book. He becomes a non-entity for almost the whole rest of the time. But since he was outspoken and opinionated in that moment, in Chapter 1, that's one of the primary things that they've incorporated here into his description. He has a tendency to be quick-tempered, yes, yes, but is also strong, brave, and loyal, presumably, yes. And, of course, he's one of the only married dwarfs in the company. Right, because, of course, he is famously the father of Gimli.
And, boy, talk about a family resemblance.
Yeah, they did a good job with that.
Yeah,
the visuals are really cool. I mean, some of them are pretty funny. Anyway.
So,
and I assume this being an app, they're going to be adding characters. There'll be updates all the time as the movie sort of proceeds and whatnot.
Yeah, probably so.
So, I'm loving the character discussion, but I would love to
yeah,
direct us toward the much more
controversial, elephant in the room. Yes.
Yeah, much more controversial part of the Hobbit app, which is the edited promotional artwork scroll.
Yes.
Where they basically removed the last couple of scenes from it. Let me see if I can dig up the links. I'm trying to remember which scenes they removed. They removed the one where there's some distant figures walking across a bridge where we didn't know what the heck that was.
Yes, that was the one that was right before the barrel. They removed the,
yep,
bear.
And they removed the bear and they removed the barrels.
Yes.
otherwise the artwork is unchanged. All of the scenes that weren't removed are there intact and completely the same as far as we can tell, including the tomatoes. And so a lot of people are kind of raising the question, why did they do this? Why did they edit this? And a lot more people are jumping to the conclusion that they did this, obviously, because they're changing where the ending of the first film is. And in fact, most famously, the OneRing.net, as they are wont to do, just came out and pronounced, well, they've spoiled the ending. Here's where the ending is. We know it for sure. It's 100%. It's settled. You know.
Yeah.
They called it a spoiler and even put it behind a don't click on this if you don't want to be spoiled about where the ending thing is. Yeah, here's their article title, Ending of First Film, Hobbit Film Revealed, Image After Break. And just for the record, I'm not convinced, actually. I think there's actually a lot of other explanations for why they might mess around with the artwork scroll. But anyway, so this has been on everyone's minds. There's a lot of people that are saying, well, this is it. We know where the film's ending. It's ending out of the frying pan and into the fire, you know, at the Eagle's rescue of the company. And then there's what a lot of other people are saying is, how in God's name could they end the film there? That's a terrible, terrible idea. And I for one put myself in the later camp of I don't know how they could possibly end the film there and not destroy the second and third films in terms of having too much material left over, and furthermore I'm fairly skeptical that they actually would end it here. So what I would love to discuss is two things. One, let's sort of talk about the merits of ending the film here. Let's assume for now that they are ending it here. Let's talk about the merits of that. Because I think just as an ending for the first film in and of itself, it's actually not a bit. It's kind of a cool ending. It'd be sort of a neat ending to. You'd be ending with a battle, and then a dramatic eagle rescue, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But more importantly, what I would like to know is one that seems to shorten the first film, which suggests that they're adding extra material to it somewhere. Where can they fill it out? I don't know because. I personally think most of the extra White Council's material you have would probably go in the later films. And then two, what are they going to do with the second and third films? How are those not going to be incredibly packed? So I would like to talk that through and then dovetail off of that to do we actually think they're going to end the film here? Have we convinced ourselves that this is a reasonable thing to do, or do we think that they've lost their minds?
It is hard to see. Here's my other question. In the first film, what exactly are we going to get other than the, you know, what we've been kind of calling the Hobbit plot? That is the quest of the, you know, the journey of the Hobbit and dwarves. What else are they going to put in? What White Council stuff do we get in the first film? What can we get in the first film? We can get lots of talk in Rivendell. But other than that, Gandalf is with them, and it does not look like they're changing that. Gandalf is obviously with them with the trolls. Gandalf is obviously with them with the goblins. So the fact that Gandalf is going to travel with them from Bag End through Rivendell across the Misty Mountains and towards Mirkwood, just as in the book, that seems in fact to happen. Therefore, where do we get the White Council? One of the reasons that I thought the post-Mirkwood break made a lot of sense is it gives us an opportunity to do, you know, because that's where then Gandalf goes. In the book, that's where Gandalf goes, is to join the White Council. So now we can get some, once they get to Beorn, we can now do a split plot thing. And we can get some. Meanwhile, Gandalf is off doing. You know, he goes. You know, maybe travels. He's heading south. Maybe he travels. You know, from the edges of Mirkwood down to Lothlorien, and we see him in Galadriel. I don't know, but that at least gave us a chance to do a lot of the stuff. Where else are we going to get the White Council plot? What of the White Council plot could we get? Gandalf not involved? Are we going to be seeing other things? Other things going off around the side? When is Gandalf supposed to be finding the tomb of the freaking Nazgul, for crying out loud?
Yeah, that I think is my big question, because all of the Gandalf White Council stuff is a little confusing to me, because in the chronology of the books, well, first of all, there's no tomb of the Nazgul.
Right.
But beyond that, By the time Gandalf is in Hobbiton recruiting Bilbo, he has already visited Dol Guldur. Is it twice? Does he go there twice?
I don't think twice at that point, but no. He'd been to Dol Guldur years.
No,
before. He had the key and the map for years before he saw.
But he knows at this point he has already done his main reconnaissance of Dol Guldur and has revealed and has discovered that the necromancer is Sauron, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, like he knows that for a fact. So, and has revealed it to the White Council, and they've already begun their deliberations. Presumably, in my opinion, so two things. One, it's possible maybe that one of the ways they're going to fill out the first film is to give more of this kind of backstory, so more events that happened before the time before the quest.
Yes.
Either front loaded at the beginning
of the
film,
or an hour into the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other question I have, though, the piece of evidence I have against that is, I don't think that we're going to come into this film with the White Council knowing that it's Sauron already. I think the filmmakers want this to be a mystery that unravels as the film goes. Now, whether that's unraveling in the same time frame as the quest, or whether it's unraveling in, like, you know, what's revealed is that actually at the time of the quest, the White Council does know this, but they don't tell us, and that we're seeing sort of flashback scenes telling the story of finding that out, interlaced with the main storyline. So there's kind of weird jumping back and forth through time. But I really don't think that we're going to start this film off with, you know, well, he's Sauron. Because I think they want this to be, in reading all those character descriptions and stuff about, like, the mystery of Azog rising and all that kind of stuff, I think they want this to be a mystery that we don't really know the answer to until late in the second film or even the third film. So I don't know what they're going to do in terms of the White Council storyline, but it seems difficult if it's not going to be told predominantly through flashbacks, and it could be, but if it's not going to be told through flashbacks, it seems difficult to add any of that to the first film, because, like you said, Corey, Gandalf is with the company the whole time. He can't be running off, flying to Mirkwood, then flying back, then flying to Mirkwood, then flying back, then flying to Rivendell. Like, the only non-flashback White Council scene we can have will be the meeting in Rivendell, which I'm guessing is going to take place while they're visiting Rivendell.
Right, exactly.
I asked Dave about this the other day. I don't think that's the case, because, look, we've got two big scenes with Elrond looking grave and very, you know, if he had a beard, he'd be stroking it. One is when they're meeting about the Morgul Blade. That's the White Council meeting. And the second is when he's talking to Thorin about the map. Now, it just doesn't seem to me in a film, in the way films get put together, that those two scenes, which are so similar in kind of interaction and nature, would be put so close together. In other words, what Dave, you're saying is those would have to be close together if Gandalf's having the White Council meeting at Rivendell at the same time the company's there. And I just don't – I can't imagine them doing that. Corey, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would mainly say I think I do incline to Dave's suggestion that we could get a lot of preamble stuff. In fact, it does seem to fit with the overall spirit of things that we're not going to start the film with the unexpected party, because that's kind of the point of the recontextualization. Bilbo's story starts at the unexpected party.
Right.
So, you know, the published Hobbit, which is ultimately derived from his private journal, surprise, surprise, starts at the unexpected party. But even the stuff, I mean, you look at the Quest of Erebor, you know, the Quest of Erebor does not start with the unexpected party.
Right.
It starts with the larger context and everything else and all the stuff leading up to the unexpected party, how they got to the unexpected party. And I expect that stuff to be there in some sense or other in the films. And so I do think, basically, the scene with Radagast that was shown at CinemaCon that we were talking about before, the Tombs of the Nazgul sequence, I would expect most likely to happen before the unexpected party.
Right.
I agree. Is so that we get Gandalf doing this kind of reconnaissance mission, and hopefully, I hope anyway, his trip to Dol Guldur at the beginning of the first film, prior to the unexpected party, so that, yeah, Bilbo. Now, of course, they have to be careful. If we don't even meet Bilbo until an hour and a half into the film, it's going to, you know, he's going to seem like a minor character. But I mean, there are various ways that could be managed. But yeah, I do think that there's going to be quite a bit of material there at the beginning. That gives us a little bit more opportunity to set up the White Council stuff. But I do have a problem. I do think cutting the film prior to Gandalf's departure from the company makes it uncomfortable because there's not much room for two reasons. Because there's not much room, therefore, for the actual movement of the White Council plot in the first film. And there's not much... And it leaves too much room, as Dave was suggesting in the second film. If you've got to do the entire Mirkwood sequence, spiders and all, plus the barrel scene, before you even get to Lake Town, and so you're going to do that and Smaug? I mean, the film is officially now called The Desolation of Smaug, so we're going to get to the mountain, so we're going to do Mirkwood and the spiders and the Elven King's Hall and the barrels and Lake Town and Stephen Fry, and then we're going to get up to Smaug and what, and kill Smaug? I mean, that's hard.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm.
That's hard. Plus, of course, all the White Council plot, because that's got to be the thick of the White Council plot right there. Gandalf is going to be away. We know Gandalf has to come back for the Battle of Five Armies. I mean, there's like a 0% chance Gandalf isn't at the Battle of Five Armies. So we have that frame, like in the book, we have that frame. We know Gandalf is there out of the frying pan into the fire, and we know that Gandalf is back by the Battle of Five Armies. So that window in between, that's your White Council window, my friends, you know, and that still seems to be true in the film as it was in the book.
And the Battle of Dol Guldur then would be probably in movie two.
Yes. Exactly. I would think, therefore, that would happen in the second film. And, you know, maybe they kind of go back and forth and they, you know, I could imagine them, for instance, sort of timing the Battle of Dol Guldur with the battle against Smaug. I could see those things happening at
like
more
a Two
or less
Towers
at the same
thing,
point.
Kind of going back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That I could see. But I am not sure. But if you've still got to do all the spiders and everything, man, that's hard. To me, here's one of the biggest things that I think. And I think that Peter Jackson is very conscious of not just Tolkien fans. And I think his primary concern, I think, is not Tolkien fans who are going to object to things like Radagast dying and not being around for the next... I mean, it's not that he's unconcerned with that, but I don't think it's his primary concern. I think his primary concern are people who are basically his movie fans.
Right.
And I think that the what he has done, that is, the stuff that he has strategically released, the trailer, the video production blogs, the materials, the photos, the photo series that have been revealed. He has established something like a contract. You know, I mean, he's made promises through this production footage, and those promises have included the barrels.
Yep.
And they've included the barrels from the very beginning. So, again, it's not to say that he can't change that. But what I do not think, and this is just based on what the conclusions I've drawn, based on what I've seen of Peter Jackson himself and the stuff that he releases, I would not expect him to let that take people by surprise. Because he has very actively led everybody to suspect the barrels in this first film. And if the barrels aren't going to happen, he's going to go out of his way, I think, to prepare us for that so that we're not just outraged and feel betrayed. Because that would be a little bit of a betrayal of the expectations which he has deliberately stoked to this point. Mm-hmm. Now, one could say, of course, that this revised scroll in the Hobbit app is step one in that process of sort of signaling that, yes, this is what's going to be happening. Yes, you know, you're going to have to wait an extra year for the barrels. one could interpret this scroll that way. And basically, I'm not ready to conclude that this scroll is conclusive, but I am. It does point generally in that direction. It certainly is consistent with that idea. And if we get other things which would seem to corroborate that, if his production videos also seem to support that idea, then I think I'll begin to think it more. But I do agree with Dave. I do not consider this scroll open and shut. It is certainly suggestive, and it is certainly intriguing, but I don't consider it open and shut.
Well, it's like I said before. I mean, one of the reasons this is an app is because it's going to grow and change. And so as you're talking, I mean, I wouldn't put it past them to even add scenes to the scroll prior to the first movie coming out. You know, that's the whole thing with this. It's going to get updated. Characters are going to get added. Scenes are going to get added. So, you know, that's a really good point. I think your whole point about the contract he's made is compelling, too. You know, you're right. I mean, I can't see him changing that. But
I'm kind of more of the opinion that if this is anything more than just the marketing people fiddling around, or maybe some kind of technical limitation, albeit a bizarre one, you know, like, oh, we couldn't fit that huge image in there or something. If it's anything more than that, I think my sort of preferred interpretation is just that they're making tweaks to that sequence from the rescue by the Eagles to wherever the film will end, including even maybe jittering the ending a little bit. Like maybe they'll end with the capture by the elves as opposed to the barrels. And I think what they're trying to do is create some uncertainty so that the ending can actually be a surprise. Yeah. Or like you said, Corey, maybe trying to prepare us for a change in the ending that we all think it will be. I don't think this firmly establishes that the ending will be at the Eagles, just because I just think that it's just a ridiculous place to end the film. I'm sure, you know, it's entirely possible I'll be eating my words in 3 months, but it just seems really unlikely. Like, I think it causes a lot of problems for the second and third film. Like,
yeah, I agree.
You know, what would be the point? What would be the point of shifting the ending here, only to put themselves in a position? Like, the whole point of having three films was to give themselves space and time to tell the story they wanted to and to not have to cut all this stuff they wanted to do. I find it really hard to believe that most of the stuff that they wanted to keep that they were cutting was in the first film.
Right.
Just seemed very unlikely to me. Given that if they were to end at the Eagles, that means over the space of the next two films they have to cover, as you were saying, Corey, the trip to Bjorn, journey through Mirkwood, the capture by the elves, the barrel ride, the arrival in Lake Town, the events of Lake Town, climbing up the mountain, sneaking in, finding Smaug, stealing the cup, the riddling with Smaug, Smaug escaping, Smaug destroying Lake Town, Smaug being killed by Bard.
The whole White Council plot.
Yeah, exactly.
And the drama,
the drama with the dwarves, the elves, and the men of Lake Town and Dale. Then the Battle of Five Armies, the return home, and the whole White Council plotline. I feel like moving the ending up this far forward completely defeats the purpose of having three films that they have space to tell all those events.
Yeah.
And as Corey said, you know, the second movie being called The Desolation of Smaug, I have to remember to say that, Desolation of Smaug, all that other stuff that, Dave, you just listed, you don't even get to the dragon until, you know, potentially midway through the second movie. Why are you calling it that
midway
name?
I mean, imagine that in an hour and a half, even if it's a three-hour movie. Imagine doing Bjorn, Mirkwood, the spiders, the capture of the elves, the time with the elves, the barrel ride, Lake Town, Stephen Fry, and doing all that in an hour and a half, even, and the White Council, and you know what Gandalf is doing down there in the south.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that is really hard to imagine. Really hard to imagine.
No, that's too hard to imagine. I was going to say, unless they're somehow shifting the White Council storyline to the first film, but no, that, of course, makes no sense whatsoever.
Because Gandalf's
with them, though. Yeah.
It's just, that's the big problem, is that you can't move the White Council stuff too far because it doesn't fit into Gandalf's books.
Right. Unless they really do have a plethora of White Council backstory type stuff to tell in terms of flashbacks.
But even that, you can't move the story forward with all flashbacks or with all... I mean,
right.
Yes, you can set things up. They could, for instance, front load the entire mystery thing that you were talking about, Dave. They could do... you know, who is this necromancer fellow and what's going on with that and the gradual discovery of that and Gandalf's uncovering of the fact that it's Sauron and the tombs of the Nazgul and whatever. All of that stuff could conceivably come before the unexpected party. But still, you're still then only at the beginning. Now what happens?
Right.
You know, now we've got you know, Sauron's plans and what he's up to and how are we going to thwart him and let's move against him and let's get together and decide as the White Council what to do, and then we're going to somehow move against him and attack him in Dol Guldur. All of that stuff still has to happen after the unexpected party. It can't happen anywhere else. Not to mention the implications of things that we have of Sauron's own, the stuff that he is putting in motion. You know, we still have to have the Zomborks somewhere, so they've got to come afterwards.
And that story's got to be developed, yeah.
Exactly. So you can't lose the Zombork plot.
Hey, I have a little ditty that's sort of slightly connected that I wanted to let you guys know, because you're talking about the beginning of the film. CBS Sunday Morning this last Sunday had a feature on Elijah Wood. And at the very end of the feature, they had some footage of him working with Peter Jackson in Frodo's character. And there were two things about that I wanted to tell you guys. One is there's a scene of him being directed by Jackson, and he's got a red book in his hand. And he's standing outside Bag End. The second one is a scene that they're filming where he's walking out the front door of Bag End and checking the mail.
Okay.
So my thought is we may not even see Bilbo and Frodo together. The frame may actually take place via letter.
Oh, that would be interesting. I think, though, even that, like, the fact that, to me, the most interesting thing about, like, Frodo wandering out to check the mail suggests that more time is being spent in the frame. Yeah, if we're going to get anything other than Bilbo and Frodo already sitting in conversation or something like that, and then cutting to a, you know, and then hearing them talk and then cutting to the, okay, if we're going to get, like, you know, 30-second pastiche of Frodo's regular daily life in Bag End, you know, that suggests to me that some time is being spent there and that's being kind of developed. Sorry, I like Ed's comment here. Ed says, you guys can't even just talk about Radagast in 2.5 hours. How do you expect Peter Jackson to get to Lake Town in less than 3? Yes, true enough. Yeah.
Anyway, I want to just add that in because we're talking about the beginning of the movie, and you know that's and he was and he's munching on an apple as he walks out the front door. That's
Interesting.
I had not seen that, but yeah, that kind of, like, you know, casual shot of Frodo in the frame is to me that's intriguing. Well, anyway, so I would definitely. I definitely am skeptical that is the definite ending. You know, maybe it is, and maybe they'll find some way to make that work. But as I say, and I, you know, basically, I and everybody else will be watching very carefully for further releases and further press stuff. You know, anything else that Jackson in particular is releasing, in particular his video stuff, because again, I think he is very conscious of the kind of expectations that he has built up in viewers, and he has been managing expectations and managing sort of reactions as carefully as he can, I think. And he's not going to be, if he's clueless about anything, it is not going to be this kind of cluelessness of saying, like, oh gosh, you know, so December 14 finally rolled around and I only gave you half the material I sort of suggested I was going to give you. Ha ha ha. Like, what? Everyone's disappointed? Everyone's outraged? Everyone's mad? Why? I mean, he's not going to be that kind of... He's going to know that would be a big deal. So I would expect lots more corroborating evidence between now and then in trailers and things. Lots more corroborating evidence to some very visible backpedaling from the previous material he has released, because I think he'd almost have to do that. We'll see. We'll see.
So are you thinking that we should stick, in terms of our own, you know, executive decision with regard to Riddles in the Dark, the show, that we stick with our original ending?
And go on and carry on to talk about Bjorn and spiders and everything else.
And elves, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, it's like a meta prediction, right? You know, like we're going to make a prediction about the relevance of our predictions. It's kind of
well. Now, as I noted, there are other things. There are other things we can talk about. I mean, we haven't talked about Sauron really yet. We haven't really talked about Bilbo specifically with the ring. You know, the ring and Bilbo specifically. I don't know.
Yeah, that definitely has to happen.
Songs and poems. You know, we could go on forever about those probably.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there's other things. It's just, you know, I guess we don't have to make an absolute decision right now, but
yeah, no, we don't necessarily right now. But no, I mean, I would actually be kind of inclined to go on and talk about Bjorn and the spiders, mostly because I mean, like, the worst case scenario is that we talk about them and it turns out we have to wait longer until we find out whether those predictions are true. whereas if we don't talk about it and it is in the first film, then we've lost the opportunity to make predictions. So
there you go. That's true.
So I guess we should probably go there.
Onward. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But other things too. So
what we'll do is I'm comfortable publicly saying I disagree with those, particularly the OneRing.net, who are saying that this definitively proves that the ending not only has been moved, but has been moved specifically to here. I disagree with that. I think this opens up the possibility that they'll move the ending, and it was something we were already considering, but I still find it highly unlikely that it will be moved substantially from the arrival in Lake Town, and certainly I think it's very unlikely it would be moved to pre-Mirkwood. And I'm comfortable enough with that, with my belief in that, that I'm willing to go on to discuss Mirkwood and Bjorn and those event post-Eagle rescue events. However, I am also I think as strategy goes, maybe the next month of Riddles in the Dark, we should pick safe topics just in case Peter Jackson releases more information.
Right. Yep. No, I agree. Ring first. We should definitely. Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay. That's just what I was thinking. Let's be confident, but hedge our bets. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hedge our bets. Yeah. That's
exactly right.
Okay.
Okay, good. Well, I think we've definitely carried on long enough.
Oh, by the way, I did want to add one thing. Let's see, where is it? Dang it. Ed has solved it. What are they going to put in the... What could they possibly fill the first film up with to take up all the time if they were to remove Mirkwood? What could they possibly put in there that we all want to see that chronologically would fit in the first film, maybe as a nice... like extended flashback sequence, you know, a good half hour to 45 minutes of action and dwarf on orc violence.
You're leading
Battle
Corey. You're, that's right. I was going to say, absolutely. You're leading Corey to answer
Battle
that.
Azanulvazar. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree. If they do that, I will forgive them.
Yeah.
I will give two big thumbs up to ending the film and Out of the Frying Pan if in exchange we get, you know, a Battle of Helm's Deep-esque treatment of the Battle of Azanulvazar.
And you'll even...
That will be perfectly acceptable.
With or without burned dwarves, right?
Well, of course. I mean, if I get the Battle of
you don't want to get too picky.
That would just be a tease to get the Battle of... as an Obazar and no reference to burned dwarves, but anyway, you know, still, no, absolutely, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. Undoubtedly, that's what they were thinking, right? Undoubtedly.
By the way, I want to add that I have a great excuse today for my animal sound effects in the background, which is because today, of course, was about Radagast. So, you know, that's my excuse. That's my story for today.
We can do it again there. With Bjorn.
Oh, that's right. I'll have a great excuse for Bjorn. Yes.
Except they have to be frightfully well behaved when we're talking about Bjorn.
Oh god.
Yes. You have to train your dog to bring you. You have to carry things in on trays.
That's
and stuff.
Right. Yeah. They'll have to be bringing me my coffee and things. Oh god. Okay. Well, I'll work on that.
You can train them.
You've got plenty of time.
That's
several
right.
weeks.
Several weeks.
No problems. Okay. Well, very good. I think we should end our official broadcast here. Thanks everybody for joining us as always, and we look forward to we are beginning to get. I have to admit, I did a little bit of a double take when Dave said 3 months just a few minutes ago.
I know.
Oh, it is only 3 months from now, isn't it?
I know.
Woohoo! So yeah.
By the way, we really got to get on the whole organizing. Determining feasibility of
I am ahead of you on that, my friend. I have already been doing that.
Corey is rubbing his hands together as we speak.
I have found and made reservations at a movie theater in Baltimore, which has, by the way, just informed me that they are definitely doing the 48 frames per second showing of The Hobbit.
Awesome.
They just confirmed that, and I am going to be reserving a cinema. We are going to do an official Mythgard-sponsored viewing of The Hobbit on Saturday the 15th. We have chosen, not quite arbitrarily, but semi-arbitrarily, a movie theater near Baltimore, Maryland. So it'll be for if people are going to... There may be one or two people who might actually be wanting to fly in, so it'll be fairly convenient to BWI. It's in Baltimore, so it's going to be... it's going to be fairly centrally located here on the East Coast for people from, D.C., Philly, New York should be able to get there. So, yes.
And we're going to do a geek weekend.
Yes. As long as we're doing this, we might as well do it. So
weekend.
I'm looking into – I'm looking into conference space. We're going to have some serious discussions and things after this. So. So
first breakfast, second breakfast, 11s.
Absolutely.
The whole bunch.
Yeah, we're looking to invite some special guests. It's going to be – that's where – I wasn't going to announce it because I'm still only in the very early stages of planning this thing. But since you bring it up, I might as well mention it.
You could always blow up.
You just can't be mysterious, Corey, can you?
No. Oh, man, I am so bad at keeping secrets. Holy cow. That's very hard.
don't say that aloud. You'll never be invited to get inside information about the film production.
Yeah, that's true. Well, see, the thing is, if I ever had inside information of the film, then basically I would not put myself in this kind of position.
Yeah,
that's what I would do. I would pre-record stuff and make sure. I mean about stuff that I'm planning. When I'm working on something that I'm always really excited to tell people about. I can't not tell people about it. I have a long history of this announcing plans that are still only half formed because I'm so excited about them while in the process of forming them that I blurted out. That's what I mean. Anyway, we are definitely planning that. That is definitely underway. We can't not have a good showing, and we're all going to get together. So yeah, we're going to rent out this whole movie theater. We'll see how many people we get who are interested in doing it. It's going to have to cost something, of course, because we need to pay for the theater. We're going to need to get food and conference space and stuff. I really want to make this into a little weekend mini conference.
It's so totally worth it to me because I won't have to be carried out struggling by security when I rise up and go, that's an outrage, because we'll all probably be doing that at the same time.
That's right. Yeah, we can and as I said, it is going to be on Saturday, so if people want to see it first on Friday and kind of get it out of their system, and then we can all see it
there
together on Saturday. That's fine. But it's going to be very exciting. So yes, the specific movie theater I'm looking into is the Cinemark Egyptian Theater in Hanover, Maryland. It's a really nice facility. I've been there before. So anyway, yeah, that's the plan. So we're working on that. We will announce it. We will announce it more formally when we have everything actually worked out. Okay, so very good. Well, then I think we should probably sign off now. So again, thanks everybody for joining us as always. So thanks for listening, and Godspeed.